All right, so we're in 1 Corinthians 7. Distinguished as the only chapter in the Bible between 1 Corinthians 6 and 8. I use the same old jokes over and over, that way I don't have to think that new material and people don't have to bother laughing.
That brings out a smile.
All right. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, what we're getting into here is really the heart of how a pastor ought to think as far as marriages in his church, how to handle that. You know, if I were to look for marriage perfection in our church and kick out everybody that didn't have it, we'd be down to a pretty slim group. We just would. I often tell people, I don't care how many times you've been married before, I just want this to be the last one. I want this to be the one that lasts forever. I want this to be the one that God blesses. Now, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And really, my wife and I live by that precept. I don't touch women. She doesn't touch men. You know, shake a hand, you know, as far as that goes. I have women who want to come up and hug. And, you know, you can't just be rude to them or whatever else. You learn the art of long-distance hugging, you know, lean over, you know, doing this. And, puppy. But you learn the art of doing that. But generally, we teach our boys, don't touch a girl. Don't touch them.
Okay? Hear that, fellas?
Yeah. And, you know, there's an allure to a girl. There just is. There's an allure to her. And, be honest, when you get your own, it's a wonderful thing to touch. You know, there's a lot of pain for people who've touched them that shouldn't. And I don't mean other people beating them up, but in the last six months, I've had to counsel three young men that the pain you're going through right now, God never intended anyone to ever feel the pain you're going through right now. Never. You're going through the pain of having gone into a relationship other than God would have had you go into it, and now it's all falling apart and you're going through pain that's second to none. It hurts so bad. You've been through divorce. Is there any pain like that? No. Sociologists say the only pain greater than divorce is death, the death of a spouse. Other than that, it's one of the greatest pains. But if you get yourself physically hooked up with a girl and you break up with her, they actually find the pain is as great as divorce. You imagine that? So the thing is, stay with the Bible precept. Don't touch a girl. Okay? Don't do it. Good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication. Now, what is fornication? Any sexual activity outside of marriage. Okay? Now, the problem is young boys like to fornicate. Different things, sexual activity, they look at porno, different things, try to relieve themselves, and then they pay for it when they get married because they're perverted in their thinking. It's not working natural. The best example I could give you is imagine your favorite meal being made. Everybody knows what their favorite meal would be. But before you came home, you just filled your gut with fudge. You ate more fudge than you've ever eaten before, and you come in the door, and there's that meal that normally gets made once a year. And oh no, I am so full, I can't even enjoy it. And that's how many young men are when they get married. They're so full of the nonsense, the porno they've looked at, and all the self-relief and all that kind of thing. They finally get this young woman, and they go, huh? And it doesn't work right. They've perverted their mind. It's not working like it's supposed to. And so they go through a lot of pain because of it. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband. Now, there's a liberty in that verse because until this was written, women had to share a husband. Can you imagine Teresa sharing him with three or four other women? And you have to work a home out and handle the kids and everything else and find out whose bed he's going to sleep in this night.
No. I can't.
Right.
Nope.
And yet, women had to go through that. And yet, there the Apostle Paul liberated them. Let every woman have her own husband. Okay? He's mine. Nobody else is getting him. Okay? He's my husband. And, yep, grab him by the ear. Let him know who owns him.
No, he doesn't like his ears touched.
All right. Well, the nose will work. Get a nose ring. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband. So one of the principal reasons for marriage, besides procreation, a lot of people say, well, the only reason for marriage is to have babies. No. Okay? It's telling you there's an entertainment value to it. All right? And it's telling you that. Okay? To avoid fornication, so that you're not just out there and having sexual pleasure in wrong places. Now, get a wife, okay? Get a wife. And nothing sadder than when a couple of people get together who have just made a mess of their lives. And they're broken and hurt inside from all the wounds they've caused themselves. And there's a lot of tears from that. And so it's so good for you to stay pure. Just so good. Do you know there's two groups of people? When I talk about the word demographics, here's what I mean. Demographics. You'll hear that word on news sometimes. They'll say, well, Hispanic households tend to do this, whereas Swedish households, that's demographics, where you study people based on maybe their ethnic group or something of that sort to study them. There's only two groups of people in the United States where the majority of their group still have a honeymoon love, that deep sexual attraction for each other after 40 years of marriage. One of them is the Amish. You know what? No television. The woman doesn't have to compete with women that are airbrushed from magazines and television and all that kind of stuff. Daddy comes out of the field and there's mama and she's weighing about 150 pounds more than she did at their honeymoon. And you know, and yet, you know what? There's just a love. There's a spark still between the two of them. And it just, it still goes. You know the other group is Orthodox Jews. Because they're just like the Amish in that sense. They're not polluting themselves with all that other outside stuff and everything else. And that natural love just stays there. And so the thing is, people say, ho, 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 we're not going to be like those old fogies, and yet they burn out after 20 years of marriage and never get to enjoy the aspects that marriage can give or anything else because they burnt themselves out with the porno and the movies and all that other stuff. And here's what I liken it to. Let's say that we took Dino and we'll give the other one to Sal. We get them each cars. And Dominic's rich, he buys his own. But we get, for Dino and Sal, we just go and buy them each a car, the exact same car. It's a pretty good car, all right? And brand new. So their dad sits there and explains to him the rules. Now, fellas, for the first 1,000 miles, I don't want you to take it over 50 miles an hour. I don't want the RPMs to be high because there might be little shavings and such still in the engine block. And we're going to change the oil again at 1,000 miles. What I want you to do is every, 20,000 miles, I want you to rotate the tires on this. I want you to change the oil. Every 5,000 miles, I want you to change it. It used to be 3,000. Newer cars can go 5,000. I want you to change it. And I want you at 50,000 miles, change the transmission fluid. I want you to do all this stuff. Boy, there, that's just fine. Sal gets in his, and he's so careful, and Dino, out of that driveway, burning rubber going around there. And you know what? All right. But regardless, you know what? For the first couple of years, he's going to have more fun. He just is. And he's going to laugh at Sal, who's just, ha ha, Sal, I got here 10 minutes quicker than you did. Ha ha, Sal, I got an extra $30. You changed your oil. Ha ha ha. But then, 3 years from then, Dino's car doesn't work well, okay? He's already got engine knocking, that kind of thing. Sal's is just still running like it did that first day. Mm-hmm. A few years later, Sal gets married. His wife gets to sit, and that car's working just like it's supposed to. Dino's on his third car now, all right? And, well, your body's the same way, mm-hmm. Okay? How you treat your body how long it's going to last and how long you can have pleasure from your body, how long you can have pleasure from your wife's body is all going to depend on how you handle things and if you handle it right. You say, well, look at those guys. They're having a ball. They're 16 years old. They're taking their girls out behind the barn and, you know, and doing whatever they want and such. And then you see that same guy at 30 and 40 years old and he's broken, hurt inside. Your dad would get on his knees and beg you not to make the mistakes he made. Okay? And he can tell you the pain. He can show you the scars on his heart and soul from the mistakes he made. You guys suffered from the mistakes he made. You suffered from them. And he's made decisions to see to it that you have a stable life, not he has a stable life. So handling these things according to the Bible, even when everything's screaming at you, don't. Handle it according to the Bible. All right. Then it says this, verse 3, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. Now, this is interesting because the context here is whether or not you fornicate and how to avoid fornicating. The due benevolence is a physical thing. That comes out of the law, where a man has a couple of wives, and it says this, you have one you don't like as much, but it says you shall not neglect her duty of marriage. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you think of Jacob's wives who had to argue, oh, please sleep with me tonight, sleep with me tonight. Why? They want babies and such. And, you know, poor Jacob come out of the field, never got a good night's sleep. There were four women always dragging him from one place to another. And, you know, just the way it was. But you know what? Paul puts the same thing on there. That duty of marriage thou shalt not diminish. Okay? And you know what? It takes work to keep a honeymoon Valentine relationship. It takes work to keep it there. There's a preacher in Georgia, Sammy Allen. He's in his 80s now. I've traveled with him back when he was in his 70s and even in his late 60s. And he's preached 50 weeks a year in other churches, plus pastored his church every weekend, and he's done it since 1960. He says there's probably no man alive who's preached more meetings than he's preached. But when he was in his late 60s and I was traveling with him, he'd do push-ups. We'd go into Walmart, and they'd have those blood pressure machines. He'd put his arm in there, it'd always be perfect. And he turned to me one day and he said, I do this. His wife's name was Jimmy Lou. I do this for Jimmy Lou's sake, okay? She deserves a good husband. I'm gone so long, when I come home, I want to be in shape. I want to be something for her. I want to look good. So I do this for her. And you know what? He meant that. For her. For her, he kept his weight down. For her, he kept himself in shape. For her, he kept himself where it's supposed to be. And it's given that wife due benevolence. And likewise, unto the wife, the husband, okay? They owe each other. Keep that thing going. Keep it working like it's supposed to. Keep that honeymoon relationship there. The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. They're one flesh. If he decides not to take his medicine, she has an issue with that. You owe me to take your medicine, okay? Yeah. But vice versa. You owe each other. Keep that thing together. Keep it right, okay? Make your dentist appointment. Make those things. Keep those things like they're supposed to, okay? And see, that's right. That's right. You can go to that verse and say, I have a verse. My wife and I, early in our marriage, got into that thing where, hey, I have a verse, you know? And I have a verse. And I'd get mad at her sometimes, but I knew it was within the bounds, you know? We're mad within bounds, you know? And, you know, she's pulling on me rank here. But the wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. Likewise also the husband hath not power over his body, but the wife. Verse 5, defraud ye not one another. Okay, and it's obvious it's talking about the very first issues we got into. Don't defraud each other. And I know more men that defraud their wives. I'm hungry, I'm tired, I got a headache tonight, or whatever else. I always want to talk about the wife doing that, but husbands do it far more than women do. Defraud ye not one another, except be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and that ye come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. You know, I tease my wife. We'll be sitting there in the house, and someone will knock at the door. Oh, I can't let them see me like this. Yeah, you let me see you like that, sitting there in your corner in the bathroom. It's okay for me to see it, but not the UPS man, you know. And, you know, but they're one of those things, to be honest with you, I don't come downstairs looking disheveled. I always shower. Always look my best. For her. Even if we're just sitting around last time, that's for her. Okay? That's for her. And she does the same for me. She makes herself look good for me. Okay? It's for me. I don't care if other guys want it, don't want it, or whatever else. But it's for me. And we do it for each other. And, you know, this idea, we tell a funny story. When we lived in Vermont, and we were still a fairly young couple or whatever, we'd get arguing, go to bed arguing. Terrible smell, go to bed arguing. Go to bed arguing, so she'd be all curled on the other side of the bed. Well, you know, in Vermont, it'd be 30 below or whatever else, and we had these heating blankets, so I'd reach over and shut off her side. She wouldn't know it. Slowly, she'd come closer to me. Pretty soon, right there. And that used to work real well until one day everybody's real happy and I'm at a party and I told that.
Oh, boy.
Bad mistake. Very bad mistake, all right?
Never worked again.
Yeah, never worked again. You know, now it's a whack. Verse 6, but I speak this by permission and not of commandment. Now, isn't that interesting? He goes back and reaches into the law on how to handle it. But says, I'm not putting you under the law. Just speaking this by permission. This is just good sense, okay? Just good sense. You know, I just ended up reading a book. When I worked in the Olean Radio Shack, the man who was his manager there was the only Jew in Potter County. He'd moved from Philadelphia, and non-religious Jew, and married a non-religious Catholic, and each one kept their own little holidays or whatever, and, you know, he just worked hard, and to be honest, they fell on hard times. Radio Shack went bankrupt, he's got a colostomy bag, and diabetes, and then his wife got rear-ended in an accident, and there was a long set of people there. She was talking to the cop and had a stroke and has never recovered from that stroke. So, you know, they're just on hard times, and I have an Audible account where we listen to Audible audiobooks. And one time I gave him the sign-in so he could listen to a couple of my books, and I hardly ever see him in the last 3 years, but he got a hold of me. He said, so I know you have a bunch of credits. Could I order this book about a Jewish rabbi? I said, oh, sure, go ahead. You know, he's getting 60 now, so he's feeling religious again. And so he got the book, and it's called On Friday, the Rabbi Slept Late. And it's written in the early 1960s, and it's about a rabbi in a Massachusetts town. And they've just gotten 50 Jewish families. It's kind of a growing town. And, you know, so they finally got 50 Jewish families in it. And they organize a temple. And it's a young rabbi in his late 20s. And he ends up solving a murder. And he does it by using Talmudic reasoning. And I have learned more about Jews. I thought I knew a lot about Jews. I'm just telling you, I learned about Jews. Friday, the rabbi slept late. Oh, my goodness. You really get into the Jewish mind as he's explaining things to the police chief and things of that
sort. So this guy ordered the book and you read it?
It's on our Audible account. So all I have to do is sign into Audible, and it's there in our library. He can sign into our account. I sign into our account.
Okay.
Yeah. But I have ordered a hard copy of it. And delightful little murder book. You know, just a fun, you know, if you like mysteries, you know, Hercule Poirot or whatever, and, you know, Hardy Boys or whatever, and, you know, it's a delightful little book, just called, and then there's a whole string of them. The next one is Saturday, the Rabbi Went Hungry. I listened to that one, too. I'm on the third one now, Sunday, the Rabbi, you know, the Rabbi Rested or something, but, is it talking about just going into the Jewish mind, how they think. And I have learned so much from them. But it goes back to this thing again. Paul, who was a Jew, learned all these things out of the law, and now he's just saying, hey, there's just good sense in doing it this way. And it's amazing. I really have understood the Jews so much better as he's trying to be a guide to this Jewish community and explain things to them, why we're Jews, why we do things different. And he says again, verse 6, but I speak this of permission and not of commandment. For I would that all men were even as myself, But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner, and another after that. So Paul didn't marry. We know that. He said, I have the power to, but I don't. I personally suspect, and I've said this again, I think Paul was divorced. And I think I could back that up fairly. I couldn't prove it, but I could give you good evidence for it. That he had had a wife. For one thing, he was a ruler. Josephus said you had to be married to be on the Sanhedrin. Mm-hmm. Paul talks about, I suffered the loss of all things. I think when he went back to Tarsus, he was sent back because of the great persecution against him. And he was sent back there. Later, Barnabas goes and finds him. Okay, and my pastor always used to say, found him broke, divorced, lost all things for the sake of Jesus Christ. And when he thought it was over and God was done with it, Barnabas showed up. Paul, we need you here. And I think there's a hint later on in this very chapter, again, the idea that he was divorced. And even then he said, I had the power to lead about a wife. I could get one, okay? But I think there's a hint to that. Can I prove that? No, I can't. Don't want anyone to listen to this think I can prove it, but I think I have a lot of good circumstantial evidence to show that. All right. So he says in verse 8, I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them to abide even as I. Okay? But if they cannot contain, let them marry. What's to contain? Obviously, that's a sexual thing. Okay? Obvious. They can't live without... You know, I'm just going around. I'm going nuts for not having a wife. And we'll let them marry. It's good for them to abide, even as I, but they cannot contain, let them marry. It's better to marry than to burn, all right? Sitting there, and I heard an old Baptist pastor said one time, there's nothing more worthless to God than a Baptist who can't contain himself sexually. And he said a lot more crude, but he said there's just nothing more worthless to God than that. Goes on, it says, verse 10, and unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. Let not the wife depart from her husband. So isn't it interesting here? He puts them back under the law. Why? Because in marriage, you're not one soul, you're not one spirit, you're one flesh. Okay? Your soul and spirit aren't under the law, but your flesh has yet to be redeemed in the rapture, and it's going to be judged by the law. Put it under the law. Make it follow that. It's good sense in marriage to follow that. So, for example, my first 16 years of being saved, my wife was lost. And the last seven of them, knowing it for sure, knowing she was lost, knowing, and just couldn't get saved. Just, she had some stuff inside that she'd have swore, oh, I've repented of everything. And when God finally showed her what was wrong, she realized, oh my goodness, how could I miss that? But that's part of the deceit of the human heart. Okay? And for her, it was hatred and unforgiveness. Same thing that kept Tanya Spencer lost. My wife grew up being sexually abused. My wife grew up in a family that was religious hypocrites, screaming at each other all the time and going off to church and everybody acting like it's all okay. But it wasn't okay. It was miserable. And you know, one of the things, when my wife was like a senior in high school, and then she, there was different mission organizations that told her, if you go to Word of Life for 1 year, we'll take you in our mission organization. She had a couple offers that way. Well, she just couldn't wait to get away from her house, but her family had no money to send her to school. So when she graduated from high school, for 2 years, she would get on the bus every day and drive into Colonial Life. And I think one time she worked for the state of South Carolina, and she'd go in every single day. And her mother used to make sandwiches on Sunday and then freeze them. And so they'd these awful sandwiches that have been frozen, and you get like one or two. And my wife would save every penny she had, dreaming of the day she was going to leave this house. Dreaming of that day and saving every penny. And finally, after 2 years, she went off to Word of Life. But my wife's not a student. And at the end of there, they gave a certificate of having attended. Aww. Which meant she's going home again, and she's all of her dreams are broken, and none of it's true. And she hated God with a perfect hatred, but didn't know it. And when she finally got saved that day, and it was Thanksgiving Day, of the year 2000. And we're driving in a van, all eight children behind us. And we're headed to Charlotte from Columbia, South Carolina. It's an hour and a half trip. And I stopped at a Bojangles Chicken in Blythewood, South Carolina to get a biscuit because all the kids had eaten. I hadn't eaten anything. I'd actually had to go to work that morning even and went and picked them up and went to get a biscuit. And she turned to me and she said, "I understand that woman." "What woman?" "She, you know, that woman in the Reader's Digest article." "What woman in the Reader's Digest article?" "Yeah, no idea what you're talking about." "Well, some 10 years earlier, she'd read an article in a Reader's Digest and gotten furious at the woman that wrote it." Actually, it wasn't even the woman that wrote it. It was the child of one of the women. But the woman had a terminal cancer, and she had three children. And she knew that when she died, none of them would remember her. They were all too young. And she knew she wasn't going to live to raise them, so she wrote each one a letter. And in each letter, she said, "Don't tell the others, but I loved you best." Well, that made my wife furious, the hypocrisy of that. How could they do that? And see, my wife's mother was an odd woman. She'd been raped growing up. She'd lost her first husband to a Japanese sniper. And then married a man 7 years younger than her who was just an unbalanced sex pervert. And who gave her next two girls. And so, you know, just her life was just shattered. And she used to say, "I don't like two of my children in the same house together. How do you love them both?" In other words, just that was a mental illness on her part. My wife grew up with that thinking and such. And all of a sudden, she turns to me and says, "I understand that woman." "What do you mean?" She said, "Remember that article?" "Okay, I vaguely remembered that article." She said, "I understand her now." "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, we just had a friend who lost their only child in a traffic accident. We were actually at the hospital when they had to pull the plug. After a week of trying to save him, and I'll never forget Inger reaching down and said, oh, I can still smell the shampoo in his hair, you know, and pulling that plug. And I mean, it was a hard, hard thing. Well, my wife was thinking, you know, Inger lost all her children at once. If I lost one, I still have seven more. And then all of a sudden she thought, no. And she thought of each of her children. If I lost that one, I lost the world. Doesn't matter that I have others. If I lost that one. If we lost Dino, we lost the world. We lost everything if we lost Dino. It doesn't matter that we have Sal. It doesn't matter we have Dominic. It doesn't matter. We lost everything. And she saw it suddenly for the first time through that standpoint. Said, I lost everything if I lose them. She said, I can't imagine any of my children I want to lose. And I just turned to her and said, Ruth Ann, don't you understand that what God is trying to tell you? That you're the only one of you? That of all the billions of people that have been made, there's not another personality of Ruth Ann Asquith. You're the only one that a trillion years from now, if you're in hell, he'll have a sad part in his heart that he lost this person. You're the only Chris Monk. Oh, there's other people with your name. We could probably do, you know, photo recognition and they might find some guy that looks like you. But you're the only one with that personality. And God stretched into himself. That's why Paul says we're all the offspring of God. The only one of that. And she began to weep. He does love me. How could he help but love me? And she went into the book of Isaiah. And I was, it's the most helpless I've ever been. I preached to other people. Where should I turn in the Bible? And I was like helpless. Well, go to Isaiah 1. And she went there and it talked how the whole head is sick, the heart is faint. And it was going over and explaining that. And she turned to me and said this. She said, I always thought I hated my parents. She said, I realize now I hated God. But I couldn't get at God, but I could make my mother cry. I could make my father sorry. But I didn't hate them. I hated God. She said, if I was at the crucifixion now, I'd show them how to pluck the beard off a man. I'd take that cat of nine, and she was weeping, hating herself for what she was saying. She wasn't bragging. She said, I would take that cat of nine tails out of their hand. I'd show them how to take the skin off a man's back. And she's weeping as she said it. And all he's ever done is love me. God saved her. All eight kids sitting in that van behind, and after all those years of not being able to get this thing right, God delivered her. I'll never forget, because we got to Charlotte to her sister's house. And her mother was standing there, and Ruth Ann went in and grabbed her mother and put her face in her mother's neck. Said, oh, Mom, I'm so sorry. I'm just so, just wept in her mother's neck. I'm just so sorry. She'd been such a disgraceful daughter. I mean, she had lived on the streets, and she had just brought every bit of disgrace, shoplifting and all these things that she'd done. Her mother later, I overheard her mother telling her husband, said, "Honey, Ruth Ann, something's happened to her." And all my kids knew that something happened to her. The hatred was gone. Okay, it was gone. And what is that? It's that thing again of realizing that God did love her. She's the only one of her kind. There might be other people named Dominic. You might even find some guy that looks just like you. But there'll never be that personality. You're the only one. Okay? Just like snowflakes. Do you realize that I think I've said this before here, but in the entire history of the world, if you took 6 times 12 and did it to the 40th power, that's how many snowflakes have ever been on the earth, ever. But the odds of any two ever being the same are 6 times 12 to the 100th power. That's the odds of any two ever being the same. In other words, no two snowflakes have ever been the same. No two personalities are the same. And when Paul said, "You're all the offspring of God," what part of us sprang forth from him? That's what he is. He's three personalities. His personality, he made one. This is Teresa. And if she were missing from heaven, he would never forget that personality, that one that was his. And he lost it. He died for it, redeemed it, and he lost it. He'd never forget that. Never forget losing that one, ever. When God so loved the world, what did he love? He loved those personalities. You know, when your children were born, and they're just beginning to suckle, you discovered those personalities before anyone else did. Each one had a completely different personality, and you loved that personality perfectly. He discovered a little later, but you loved that personality perfectly. And there, every single one of the people that ever lived, God has loved that personality perfectly. Hated their nature, hated their character, hated the things they did, but loved that personality. And labors to make men see what's wrong with them. Because if he could show them, if they could just see it, he could forgive it. All right. So I lived with a wife for 16 years who was lost. And there were times it was a grievous, hateful thing. Okay? I've seen her almost crawl to the door begging me to divorce her. I'm destroying your children. And no, God said stick with her. And boy, what a gracious, wonderful thing. You know, that God just kept us together. And, you know, the fellowship we have now in Christ Jesus is just second to none. There's just nothing like it. Verse 13, "And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife," set aside. God sees him as different. God sees him as holy.
We skipped verses 10 through 12.
Oh, let's do 10. "And unto the married," thank you. "And unto the married I command, not yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband." Okay, there we go back to that. "And if she depart, let her remain unmarried. Or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife." Now, a lot of people stop right there. See, they can never marry again. And you're going to see he makes provision. Okay? It would be better if they didn't. Okay? There just is a thing there. For their own holiness or whatever else. But yet God has made provision. Verse 12. "But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If a brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let her not put her away." Thank you for showing me that, Teresa. "And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let him not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy." Noah got to bring his children on the ark because they came from a saved man's family. Okay? The Presbyterians and the Calvinists teach that the children of saved parents are part of the elect. That's a damnable teaching. Okay. I remember hearing a preacher preach one time. Says, "Well, I don't ever remember a saving moment, but my parents were saved, and I remember thinking, oh, what an awful thing." Verse 15, but if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not in bondage in such cases, but the Lord has called us to peace. There is no bond there. Okay? If they leave because they're lost, and that's not because you're a jerk to them or drunk and slug them in the face, but they left because of that, there's no bondage. You know, and again, keep this in mind. If I were to poll the room of who hates divorce, no one hates it more than he does. There's nobody. The next three would be these boys right down here. No one hates it more than they do, okay? They've suffered from it. When I talk about divorce, God forbid that anybody think that I'm trying to throw stones at people that have been through it, because they hate it with a passion that no one else could ever feel hating it, okay? If I'm talking against cancer, I'm not trying to be against people that have it. Nobody hates it more than a person's had cancer. So verse 15 again, but if the unbelieving depart, let them depart. A brother or sister is not in bondage in such cases, but the Lord, but God hath called us to peace. For what knowest thou, man, whether thou shalt save thy husband, or wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or what knowest thou, man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? I have a number of people in my church who they have one is saved, the other is not. And again, I'm not one of these people, go rub a magic wand over them, have a prayer. That hasn't worked in the last 50 years. Instead, live together, learn, let God save that other one. God did it in my marriage, he can do it in many. Verse 17, but as God hath distributed to every man, so the Lord hath called every one, so let him walk, and so ordain I in all churches. Is any man called being circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Now let me tell you, I'm going to break in the middle of that verse. There is a physical way to uncircumcise a man. It's very painful. Goes in there, and it's carving, and it's plastic surgery. But when the Greeks took over Palestine, under Antiochus of Epiphanes, a Jew wasn't allowed to run in the Olympics because they all did it butt naked if he was circumcised, and they would actually go through the agony of letting a Greek doctor carve on their privy member and stretch that skin down and make a new foreskin, okay? So just so we understand, there is a physical aspect to this, but he's also talking about the sense of you know, just how you've lived and that kind of thing.
What was the purpose for that?
Because it was an offense to the Greeks that they were circumcised. They were like Nazis. They didn't want people circumcised.
Oh.
Okay. Is any called an uncircumcision, let him not be circumcised. You know, there was an old wives' tale out there 30, 40 years ago that people weren't circumcised, were dirtier and such. That's been proved not to be true, okay? Mm-hmm. It is not a true statement. You know, circumcision is just a choice if people want to do it or not want to do it. So it says this, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing but the keeping of the commandments of God. That's the only reason they're in there. We're not under the commandments. We don't need to do it. Let every man abide in the same calling wherein he was called. Art thou called being a servant? Care not for it. But if thou beest made free, use it rather. Okay? For he that is called in the Lord being a servant is the Lord's free man. Likewise also these called being free is the Lord's servant. You are bought with a price. Be ye not the servants of men. Okay? So it's one of those things that if you can live a life without putting yourself in servitude, by the way, that has to do with debt also. Don't get into debt that doesn't need to be. If you got to drive a worse car, drive a worse car. Do what you can to stay out. If you have to go into debt for a car, then you have to go into debt for a car, okay? But you have made yourself a servant to people. You're not free to go move, do whatever you want to do. All right. Then he says this, verse 24, brethren, let every man abide. Let every man, wherein he was called, therein abide with God. Now, concerning virgins, whether it be a man or a woman, let me tell you something again. Everybody harps on women. Stay a virgin, stay a virgin. No, you guys stay virgins, okay? Everybody has this thing, well, what are you, some little wimp because you're a virgin? No, I'm a man, that's why I'm a virgin, okay? I don't have to go around and prove things to people. Mm-hmm. All right? What I have is for my wife. And it's going to be better than what your wife's going to get. All right? I'm a man. That's what I am. Stay a virgin. The ones who don't, there's tears. There's just tears you don't want to cry. There's bitterness you don't want to live through. Okay? Stay a virgin. I have sons who did, and I have sons who didn't. Okay? And the ones who didn't, they'll tell me, Dad, that's the worst thing I ever did. It hurt, it hurt, it hurt. And the ones who did are so glad that they did. So it goes on and it says this. Concerning virgins, verse 25, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. I suppose, therefore, that is good for this present distress, I say, that is good for a man so to be. Art thou bound unto a wife? Seek not to be loosed. Art thou loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. But, if thou marry, thou hast not sinned. Did Joseph Sorello sin when he married Teresa, according to that verse? No, he did not sin when he married her. That's what the verse says, okay? Now, here's the advice that I give. First of all, if a guy's been out there being a fornicator and he's been one flesh with different women, I tell him, don't go around looking for a wife. Treat yourself just like this. That's how I treated myself. Yet if God brings a wife across and a woman across, that's a good thing. God did that for me. God brought a woman across the church and I realized, oh my goodness, God brought me one. And it was a good thing. I'm glad I didn't go out there searching for one. For one thing, my mind was too mixed up because of fornication. I'm not sure I'd have made the right choices, okay? Instead, God made the choice for me. But, and if thou marry, thou hast not sinned. And if a virgin marry, she hath not sinned. See? Both of you are safe. You didn't sin. Nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh, but I spare it. And there is trouble in the flesh. Tell me, Joe, it's not more trouble to have had one wife and, you know, sharing kids. It is. There's trouble in the flesh. Tell me you're not going through more trouble in the flesh than a woman who married someone who's never been married. You are, okay? It's just
that. There's more trouble in the flesh than a woman who's never been married.
That's right. It is. And you have that trouble in the flesh. And so you say, okay, you know, I've made up my mind and this is a decision I made. I'm going to go through this. Okay, we're big boys. We're big girls. We can handle it, you know. If you lost your arm, would you quit working? No, you're just going to have more trouble in the flesh because you lost your arm. Yeah. But this I say, brethren, that the time is short. Remain that both they that have wives, although it be as though they had none. What's that mean? Well, I have known men have handled that wrong. What it means is this. If God calls Joe to do some kind of work for the Lord, he can't say, well, I have a wife, I'm not going to do it. That's a bad mistake, okay? You say, no, I'm going to go do this work. It's going to be harder because I have a wife. It's going to be harder because I'm dragging kids around. There was a book published by the Grace Baptist Church of Norfolk, Virginia, which isn't function as a church anymore, but it was formed back in the 1940s, and I used to know one of the men who formed the church. And an old couple left China when the Chinese took it over and came to that church, and they were an old couple. They'd been in China since the 1890s. And so someone in the church sat down and wrote their story out, and the church privately published that story. And in that story, both of them had gone to China as single people. And when they went to China, they're both single, and they were 1,000 miles apart, but they were both working for the same mission board. They'd never met each other. And so there was a conference where all the missionaries came together, and they went by train, and this would have been a time when England and France and America all had spheres of influence. But they went together, and they met each other for just a few moments, and then went back again. And the guy said, he was praying, Lord, said, that was your wife. Well, Lord, I probably won't see her again for a few years. No, you get a hold of her. That's your wife. And in a couple of days, he was like ashamed to get a hold of her. And finally, he sent her a telegram. And she's, well, I've been waiting. God showed me that you were to be my husband. And they married. And they were in this village in China, and they never had children, and it was such a sorrow to them they couldn't have children. And he used to preach to the Chinese because of their awful thing of taking women babies and putting them out on a rock to let them die. And he used to preach about it. Well, one day, they look on their back porch and there's a baby. So the Chinese, all right, big boy, you take him. And they took her in and then realized she's blind. Well, they raised her. And she turned out to have an unbelievable talent with music and sewing. And pretty soon, they had 300 because people heard that they would take blind babies. And so they had this huge orphanage. And it was a place of joy. And they had a sewing factory and taught each one of them skills and things. And they taught them these things. And he used to talk about, he said, never did any of the people in our village ever get saved. He said, but they never realized that when the drought was there, I was the man on the hills begging God to send the rains. When the locusts came, I was the one begging God to take the locusts away, and the locusts would leave. And he said, but they brought us those children, and we raised them all, 300 children that were raised and had careers and could live blind and things before the Japanese finally came. But he told this story. He said, we had some British friends who we would go to their house, and on their mantelpiece was a picture of two beautiful blonde girls. And we asked them, who are those? Oh, those are our daughters. Well, where are they? Oh, we disobeyed God. They called us, God called us to the mission field, and we said, oh, Lord, we can't take those girls. So when they're gone, we'll go. Well, they were gone in the year. They were gone in that year. And they said, if we'd obeyed God, they'd be here, and we'd be raising them. They'd be with us. But we disobeyed God. So when Paul says, they that have a wife, as if you didn't have one, if you hate her, take her under consideration whether or not to do what God wants. But if you love her, don't consider her. Do the ministry, then consider her. Mm-hmm. Then make it comfortable for her. Then do what you can. But make your decisions as if you didn't have her. Okay? But if you hate her, bring her into consideration.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, I appreciate
that. All right. Verse 30. And they that weep, as though they wept not. And you know what? There's times when things just make you weep. You just got to act like you're not in sorrow. Just go do what you got to do anyway. And they that rejoice, as though they rejoice not. You know, you're flipping over backwards and rejoicing over things. Just we'll handle it on an even keel. And they that buy, as though they possess not. And they that use this world, as not abusing it. For the fashion of this world passeth away. You know what? You have to use things of this world, but don't abuse the things of this world. Don't fall in love with the things of this world. They're all tools that God gave you. And you know what? From time to time, have a good time. You know, from time to time, enjoy things. You boys need to have fun and such, but don't abuse it. You know, it's all part. It's all got to be tempered. The word temperance in your Bible, so many people define it as self-control, and it's not. Temperance is the exact right amount. Things tempered together in the exact right amount. When you cook, you have to have certain things in there, but you temper it. Exact right. And you'll find that word used that way in the recipes of Leviticus. Tempered with this, tempered with that. Having that right amount of stuff. You know, too much fun last week? Temper it this week. You know, too much work the week before? Temper it this week. Get it in that right amount. Don't abuse the things of this world. Verse 32. But I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. And of course, Joe's got to think of that, you know. He's got to go out there and think to himself, you know, what do I get? Well, I used to get this as a bachelor, but, you know, Teresa doesn't like that. You know, and, you know, a little bit better of this and that. You know, and it's part of it. And to be honest with you, it's kind of fun. I enjoy doing that for my wife. I enjoy it. Verse 33, but he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, I may please his wife. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy in both body and in spirit, but she that is married careth for the things of the world, how that she may please her husband. And you know what? That is. It's her duty. Please your husband. Make things happy for him. Make things go the way he wants. And, you know, at the Hampton Road Conference, 1604, where it was decided to do the King James Bible. And it's called the Hampton Roads Conference.
But I just watched a video about that a couple days ago.
Okay.
That's cool.
Yeah, but Dr. Reynolds was there, and he complained to King James about the marriage ceremony. Because in the marriage ceremony, a woman would say, "With my body I do thee worship." Mm-hmm. And he complained about it, and James said, "Well, if you worshipped at our altar, you'd like it better." He was a single man. He said, "If you worshipped at our altar, you'd like it better." Yeah, I know what I mean. All right. Now it goes on, it says this. Verse 35, "And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, that you may attend upon the Lord without distraction." This is what he really wants. You know what? If your marriage is working right, each one of you ought to be able to attend to the Lord like you ought. "But if any man think that he behaveth himself uncomely toward his virgin, if she pass the flower of her age..." Now, the flower of her age is obvious. She's become sexual. Every woman knows the little signs when that's happening to a woman, okay? That's where she attains the flower of her age. Passing the flower of her age means that her parents have observed and said, the bodily maturity, you're going to have to make this decision one day for a young lady, the bodily maturity that she needs to be a mother, she has reached that goal. Whether or not she has the mental maturity or the emotional maturity is a different thing. But the scandal back in the Middle Ages, for example, I remember reading a thing by a queen where she wrote and said, no woman ought to get married, you know, younger than 13 or 14 years old, because she'd been married off at 10. And the agreement in those days was is the man wouldn't touch her until she passed the flower of her age. But so many of them suffered because the men did. Okay, and so the whole idea is, who makes the decision that she's passed the flower of her age? The father with the wife makes that decision. She has passed. One day, Chris, you'll be the one to determine. She hasn't just reached the flower of her age where she can flower and reproduce, but she's passed it. She's reached this point where she's reached a point of physical maturity, her hips, her breasts, her reproductive organs, they've reached that point that it's not going to develop more than it is now. Some girls have done that in a 14-year-old body, some in a 17-year-old body. That's a decision that a father and a mother make together. And until that point, there's no liberty to marry her off, none whatsoever. I have known girls who at 16 and 17 could marry and could raise a family and do well. I have known others at 21 and 22 were too foolish, okay?
Oh, the cat.
Trying to claim my back.
Yes.
You were playing with his.
Yeah. Turnabout's fair play. All right. So, past the flower of her age, and need to... Okay, verse 36 again. If a man think himself behave himself uncomely towards his virgin, if she have passed the flower of her age, and have known... And... her age, and need so require, let him do what he will, he sinneth not, let them marry. Nevertheless, he that standeth steadfast in his heart, having no necessity. Now, let me tell you something here. It means he's not burning. The only woman here who's ever probably lactated is Miss Sue, who's actually nursed a baby. Okay? And she would understand this. But she produced her milk by the baby's need and her emotions. Okay? When that baby didn't need as much, she went through a little bit of suffering. Her breasts would swell, they'd hurt a little bit, but then her body would take over and actually produce less milk. A man produces his need the same way. If you listen to the public health things, they think what's going on inside of a man, a certain amount of himself is being produced and it's got to be relieved every once in a while. No. A man produces according to emotion and need. A man who is not watching porno, who does not have a wife, and is not sitting and allowing himself to get sexually aroused, will not have a need. And Paul said so right there. Okay? He said that. Under the Jewish law, if the seed of copulation came out of a man in the night, he was unclean. said so. Okay? We don't have that upon us. It says the marriage bed is undefiled. That doesn't mean a man and wife can take a, you know, a whip and a goat to bed or whatever. It just means that you'll find marriage manuals that say, oh, anything goes in a marriage bed, it's undefiled. No, it just means that you can have a honeymoon relationship, go straight into the throne room of God afterwards. You're not like the Jew that had to wait 3 days, okay? It's undefiled. There's no problem there, okay? That's what it's saying. There's no problem there. The point of that is this. A fella asked me one time, did Jesus Christ have wet dreams? Okay? Well, was he a real man? Okay? Was he a real man?
Yeah.
Yes, he was. But if he did, he would have been unclean. Could he be unclean? No. Here's the verse that explains it. He had no need.
I thought this was a father giving his daughter away.
But it also dealing with the man himself. It's intertwined here. It's a man that's a virgin, him taking his virgin, and having no need. Okay? It's difficult to unwrap the three or four almost that are involved in that. But a man can have no need and not burn. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult in our society. Why? Because everywhere here, turn, cars are sold through sex, food's sold through sex, everywhere.
Yeah, but you know what? Christ, he had no need.
That's right. Because he had no of your thoughts, and it's not a thing where there's a spigot on inside, and every once in a while it's so full you got to go empty the
jar. He was so in love with his father.
That's right.
That he had no need for a woman.
That's exactly right. The lesson in there, again, is when you hear health professionals talking about this, well, you know, guys got to relieve themselves. No, they don't. They only need to relieve themselves if they're thinking unclean thoughts, or if they have a woman and have the proper emotional relationship with her. But woe and the sorrow of a woman who has a man who uses her for relief for his porno thinking. Okay? Woe unto such a woman who has had to suffer through that. Okay? And every man's caught himself in that kind of thing, and boy, you just better stop that. It needs to be her personality, her breath, and the thought of her, and her hair, and the beauty of her that makes that thing work. So, verse 38, so then he that giveth her in marriage, that's the father, no doubt, okay? Doeth well, but he that giveth her not in marriage doeth better. The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. Isn't that something? Here's Paul who's told people over and over again, you're not under the law, not under the law, not under the law. But your flesh hasn't been redeemed yet. And it's one flesh.
Yeah, but you also put yourself under a law when you make that.
That's exactly right. You've made vows. You put yourself under civil law and the law of God. So the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. So if he gives you lip, shoot him.
What?
Yeah.
I think there's civil laws I would be breaking.
Yeah, that probably so, yeah. You know, I had a woman who was coming to the church for a while, who's probably the single most rebellious person I've ever known in my life. Her father had been a missionary, and she married a guy from off the mission field. They're actually up in northern Canada. She married a guy who grew up in the Arctic, and just a rebel, and he was a rebel, and she married him, and then she broke his heart 1,000 times over, whatever else, and he became fairly successful in business. And I met him, and they're having trouble, and I finally told him, I said, you know what you need to do? You need to get a couple of passports, and you need to move to Saudi Arabia, take her in a hotel, and take a rod and beat her. And he laughed. And I just said, yeah.
Did she hear him say that?
I told her later. Uh-oh. I said, her daddy never did it. And I said it was to her destruction, and there's no, and yeah, you end up divorcing. There was no, I'm just the single most rebellious person I think I've ever known. And just rebellion was her problem. And just, it was, nobody could tell her what to do. And you looked at her life, you could just see no one could ever tell her what to do. And her children suffered, she suffered, her husband suffered, her parents suffered. I mean, just an awful thing. All right, verse 40, but she'd be happier if she should abide after my judgment. I think also that I have the Spirit of God. Do you realize that 1 Corinthians 7 is one of the few places, everywhere else that Paul writes, he is making reference to somewhere in that Old Testament. I find them over and over again. There's no reference Bible that'll show you. You don't have any little thing in the middle show. No commentaries. No. But if you follow, you'll find, oh, he's making reference here. He's making reference to this. The only place where he steps out is 1 Corinthians 7. He tells you that. He said, not I. You know, I have no commandment of the Lord, but here's my judgment on this. Where he actually steps out, and then other places he actually puts you like no other place under that law. So it's a fascinating thing to get into 1 Corinthians 7. But, Joe, why don't you close us?
Dear Lord God, I do thank you for this night and this time. And, Lord, I thank you for the message tonight, Lord. Lord, I really set in my heart, Lord. Lord, I pray that you continue to work with us and guide and direct us as we do Monday night Bible study. Lord, I do pray for Pastor Asquith as you get him home safely. And Lord, just thank you for this time. In Jesus' name, amen.